Hey, everybody. Welcome to Hobbs and Friends of the OSR. I'm Jason Hobbs, and with me today, I have got Jose Licario of the Panhandle Licarios and John the Birdman Bird. How you guys doing?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me, man.
Hello, Jason.
Hey, Jose. All right, so we're all a little squirrely. It's kind of the last hour here, and this cat is going crazy on my lap, but you guys got anything you want to say about yourselves before we get going?
They may remember me from such podcasts as Hobbs and Friends of the OSR, episode 2.
And Bird?
Probably haven't heard me in a podcast before. I've probably known you for quite some time, 20-some, 30-some years.
Yeah, a couple days.
A couple days, yeah.
He's also known as the Chess Master by Doug Kovacs. Not because he's good at chess, though. So there you go. So let's talk about what we did in gaming since the last episode. I played Bravos of the Philic Isles, which is Paul Wolf's Labyrinth Lord game. I ran one session of my Kalmata game, which we'll probably get into later. And then I also played with Jared Rasher in his Shadow of the Demon Lord game. How about you, Bird?
I also played Bravos game with Paul Wolf, and I played in your Kalmata game for this week.
Jose?
Same here. The only game I actually fit in this last week was the Kalmata game.
Oh, you guys are so lucky. So today we're talking to two guests, which is unusual. It's the first time we've done this on my show. And the reason we're doing that is because the game of the week this week is going to be Kalmata. But before we get to that, you know I have to do one of my favorite segments here that I introduced with Jose, which is Everything About You. So I usually want to say one thing about myself that my listeners don't know, and then I'd like to have my guests do the same if they could. So for me this week, I figure it's time for me to let you know that I started gaming about 1978 with the Holmes edition, and my GM was my older cousin, Patrick Stevens, also known as Hawk, and he actually is doing art for the zine, so that's kind of an interesting circle for you. How about you, Jose?
I'll give you my gaming beginning story as well. I started in 1983 at the age of 8. You can go ahead and do the math there. I'm old. I started in elementary school in the 3rd grade. We had a little program where all the smart kids could take a couple of periods out every day, once a week or so, and play Dungeons and Dragons in the library. This is when in the early 80s. Knowing that, I am an original nerd. I actually got to take time out of my schoolwork to play Dungeons and Dragons.
How about you, John?
I'll go with my starting session for me as well. I started with the Mulvey version of BX, and it was more of, I had an uncle introduce me to BX, and I picked it up and I read it, but I didn't do anything with BX at all, just kept on Reddit trying to find a group to play. It wasn't until actually high school when I actually was able to start playing games.
Who'd you start playing with when you were in high school?
Yeah, this bumpkin by the name of Hobbs.
Yeah, so John Burt, he went to high school with me, and we've been playing games ever since. That was around 1986, probably. So there you go. But we couldn't play Basic then because I was too good for that. We had to play Advanced instead, right, John?
Yeah, Basic was for beginners.
I'm sure you both had moose in your hair. So there was a lot of things going on in the 80s. No one wants to admit.
That's true. Let's get right to it then. The game of the week this week is my Kalmata, my BX Kalmata game. And the reason I have two guests is because instead of me just babbling about my game, I thought it would be much cooler and a little more humble to actually have two guests that could mostly just talk to each other, and I'll just try and step in whenever I need to. So the game is, it's called Kalmata, Island of Adventure. It's mostly, it really is just a love letter to Treasure Vaults of Zatabod. I started running this game because Eric Hoffman's game was coming to a hiatus, and I basically offered to run another BX game. We used pretty much the same house rules, and a lot of the same people were invited over to the other game. I think it's gone fairly well. More recently, I've started to run it twice a week because some people asked for another day. I'm starting to get a little tired of that, so I don't know how much longer that's going to go. How about you, Jose? Do you have any sort of introduction to the game you want to talk about?
Well, I don't know if you've mentioned it previously, but it's kind of set in the future, fast-forwarded from the Treasure Vaults of Zatabad, right? Some number of years. the events in that module have already occurred in our campaign.
Yes, that's true. It's 50 years in the future is what I say, and it's after the big event that's just supposed to be when the adventurers finally find the actual treasure vaults of Zadabad and steal all the treasure, basically.
Yeah, so I find it interesting that you gave us the opportunity, and you actually encouraged us to go and read the entire module as kind of background material for this campaign. I've never experienced that before, so it was kind of neat. I still haven't done it. It's, you know, like 50 pages of reading. Most people won't read a page of background material, so, but I'm going to get to it eventually.
I don't even have Zadabad, so I can't even partake in that opportunity either.
Well, the reason I really did that is because Eric had time to play in a game, but he didn't have time necessarily to run a game, and so I wanted him to be able to play as well, and I thought, if I'm going to play Zadabad, I certainly can't be the normal way, because he'd know everything and how much fun is it to play and something that you actually wrote, I suppose. But if I changed it that way and changed all of the encounters and all of the rumors, everything that existed is still there, but I've added quite a few new things. Bird, did you have any introductory statements you wanted to make?
There's some things I know you had coming in behind the fact with the Selvan and actually finally seeing them come to fruition. This I thought was really interesting this last session or two.
I basically put Treasure Vaults of Zadabad in my own setting, which I call the Emergent Empire setting, which is would just be more background for everybody, and so it wasn't required reading, and I don't make anyone take any of the cultures from that, but they all exist as far as I'm concerned as when the NPCs and stuff show up, which kind of leads to when the game first started, neither Jose nor John, or John, actually, you might have been in the first session, right?
I was not in the first session.
I think it was like Paul and Eric, but anyway, it was pretty, I mean, I'm not one of those guys who does tons and tons and tons of prep ahead of time. In a hex crawl, you kind of have to do quite a bit of prep because they can go anywhere they want, and the amount of player agency is to the utmost most of the time. Obviously, there's still a box, that's why they call it a sandbox, but it does have a lot more choices for the players and where they want to go.
That's interesting that you mentioned that, because that kind of was an interesting, to kind of segue into your game from last week. It's interesting that you mentioned that it's a sandbox, because we had a situation. You were actually not that happy with last week's game. You thought it dragged a bit, and we talked about it a little bit before the show. It was because, in retrospect, you spent the entire first, probably half of the session throwing out hooks for us, and we just blindly ignored them because we were headed towards the city of Zadabad. And we had blinders on, so every time you threw out a hook, hey, there's some ruins. You can see some ruins in the jungle. Now we're good. You know, hey, this guy tells you about some ruins in the jungle. No, we're good. One of the characters has a life quest to do something. We get a sniff on that mission. Now we're good. Just blindly ignoring every hook in the session. And that's what happens in a hex crawl. If they don't take your hooks, there's just a lot of crawling. And I think that's why you probably felt like the session didn't go well.
Well, it was slow, that's for sure. And I didn't roll a ton of stuff. The random encounter tables that I use for that, especially when you're just exploring new hexes, is basically with a die 12. And, you know, on a 1 to 8, nothing really happens. And then say 8 to 10 or 8 to 11, there's a lair or a tomb, and then 12 is something else. And then I have all these different tables I roll on. So every time you're going into it, every 6 hexes, I do that, because originally the map for Treasure Vault of Zadabad was 6-mile hexes, but this game is played on roll 20, and I thought it would be more interesting if it was a 1-mile hex. I just don't know if I hate myself and I want to add more work or what, but that is what I did. I converted the entire map to 1-mile hexes.
Well, we get experience per hex explored, so that's kind of nice for us.
Yeah, that really works well.
It's like 36 times the experience that we would have otherwise gotten, so that's
pretty. Well, I would have to give you more XP for a 6-mile hex than I would a 10. But, I mean, in a BX game, you know, you're not even necessarily, it's rules as written, you don't get XP for anything but treasure. Or do you, no, they give you XP for monsters, but we kind of adjusted that in our game, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of our BX and OSR games, we've thrown away the monster XP because it's so inconsequential at low levels. Not only that, it's annoying to keep track of, and it's easier to give some sort of session XP, which kind of rolls all that, everything they did in terms of monsters and stuff, and then just count up the gold. And almost everyone I know runs it that way. You do. Hoffman runs it that way. It's pretty popular.
Yeah, that's why we do it. And Paul's Bravos of the Philic Isles game is Labyrinth Lord, but he does the same thing, just gives session XP. Usually, I think the reason for that is because we put so much time into actually playing. I'm not saying we don't joke around and do a lot of grab acid in the beginning of the game, because obviously we do. But at the end of the game, you know, you're trying to wrap it up, and instead of trying to calculate all these extra XP from monsters, it's a lot easier just not to worry about it and just let the players do the other stuff, and then just from the gold pieces, and then do the experience that way.
Yeah, and you can always add, if they have a big, you know, a big encounter, you know, meet that titular dragon that everyone talks about, and they end up killing a dragon or something, you can throw in extra session experience.
Yeah, there's always opportunities for bonus experience, definitely.
Exactly. So it's much easier bookkeeping.
And I think also the other thing, too, is we always seem to be coming to the rails of we're always past when we say we're going to be done. So you're trying to wrap up all that book work and to add up every little creature you fight just seems to be tedious.
Yeah, we're all old people now. We need our sleep.
Yeah, it is tedious for me. And honestly, most of the prep that I do for the sessions is done ahead of time because you can go anywhere and it's a big map. The game is originally was centered around the single village of Sindonor. And it's this village that was once a plague colony. And the people there have had a lot of issues just because the homeland, the colony that they're of, wants nothing to do with them because obviously the people with the plague were just sent here and then they were quarantined. And so they never came back. And that's really the story that's in Treasure Vaults of Zadabad. And then what I did is said that people came and more adventurers came searching for the treasure vaults. And that added some wealth to the village of Sindonor. But now after that was gone and it had been 50 years since it happened, a lot of that has become run down. And it was really just a small amount of people that lived in the village. Like you couldn't even buy metal armor or anything. So if you wanted to try and equip your henchmen, you know, you were pretty much screwed, right?
Indeed.
Or come in with lower equipment and you're trying to improve your own equipment to get to that plate mill or chain mill. It's like it doesn't exist, so you can't get it. So you have to hope that you find that equipment through the adventures because you're not going to get it in town.
Yeah, and that's a pretty classic staple of a lot of the OSR games is resource management. And again, like with the added wrinkle of the house rule of the shield sundering, where you can sacrifice your shield to stave off a particularly damaging blow, then you're burning through shields too. So there's always that resource management element. And in a place like Sindonor, where there's already some scarcity built into that setting, it becomes doubly so. So yeah, that's an interesting aspect of it for sure.
All I gotta say is that shield smith's gotta be pretty rich after we're done.
That's yeah, we burn through some shields. I mean, our donkey looks like a turtle covered in shields on the way to the dungeon every time because we got spare shields and everything else.
Yeah, I didn't want to remove that aspect of the shield, so then I said that you could have wooden shields, but then it was like, well, then metal shields should be better, and so then I added a hit point thing, and I don't really think that rule has stuck that well. I've maybe enforced it a couple times, but other than that, we haven't really been too concerned about it.
Yeah, I actually liked that rule. It was it would absorb 10 points of damage if you sunder it, but I think part of the problem is we're a little bit lower level, so we haven't taken like a 12 or a 15 point blow and had that bleed over damage yet. But I think it's a good idea, and especially if you know, the wooden shields are cheaper, it still might be worth it for us depending on what we're fighting, because we do burn through a lot of shields.
I think another good idea to add to that is if you actually do get a metal shield, is say if it takes less than 10, maybe it can take 2 hits to make that worth that much more if you want to go down that road.
I think I was just going to say metal was 20 or something like that. I don't want to give you 2 hits because then that increases the amount of shields you can go through in a session.
you still have your limit of you can do two sunders.
Oh, but then what does a magic shield do, you know? So, I don't know.
More sunders. See, this is the negotiation that goes through in an OSR game with the DM. You have to scrape and scrabble for everything you get. But that's okay. That's part of the fun, you know? It's not, he can't point to a rule and go, no, the rule says no. You can kind of lure your way into some stuff, so it's nice.
There is definitely discussion involved, but most of the time I'm pretty easy. I mean, it's so easy for a character to die in a BX game that to me, I don't really care too much. I'm not concerned with the lethality level not being high enough. So I'm not concerned with that most of the time. I usually let guys walk all over me. Just ask these guys.
Oh, give me a break. I go through characters like Kleenex nowadays. I'm surprised my last character has lasted so long.
That's because you're not playing a female mage.
Yeah, my last two female mages lasted like 10 minutes. So, true. So, interestingly enough, too, in you mentioned that you have a Tuesday game. Some of our characters from the Monday game have transitioned into that Tuesday game because the Monday characters had the option of traveling to Zadabad, and they went on an expedition with an interesting character that we met during our travels. And so those characters that went to Zadabad are in the Tuesday game and no longer interacting with any of the Monday characters who stayed behind, or for those of us playing in both sessions, the characters that they've created for the Monday game again. So now we have Monday characters and Tuesday characters that are different. So that's pretty cool too. And they're all tied together.
Yeah. If you're a guy that plays in both sessions, then you got two characters. If you wanted, though, if you would have had two characters that stayed in Sindonor, you could do that. But the other one is days travel away. So we kind of have them separated. And it's usually, I think, the higher level characters pretty much are the ones that are in Zadabad now.
Right.
Which is a city in the center of the island, which is called Kalmata, in the middle of the jungle, where the original treasure vaults were located. But this new character race, well, it's not really, it's a NPC race, showed up during one of the sessions, probably about 20 sessions in, I'd say 15 to 20 sessions. And that was the Sailvin that Bird mentioned earlier. The thing you should know is that my Emergent Empires game has no elves nor halflings.
Racist.
I'm not going to comment on that. I decided that some people like to play elves, and the idea of having the magic user fighter class is good. So I wanted to give that option, but I didn't want it to be elves because in the history of my setting, the elves were gone. So I made this these character called the Sailvin, which are inspired by the... Heck, I don't even know what the race is called because there's always something that I don't know the answer to that I should whenever I talk about this show. But it's on Clash of the Titans or Wrath of the Titans. Which one do you guys know?
It's probably Wrath of the Titans. I don't remember any because the Sailvin are...
They're the wood-like creature.
Yeah, they're tree-like. They have like bark-like faces.
It's the guy who healed the protagonist in one of the movies. He had the blue ball that came out.
I think it's the second...
Pardon me, sir.
I think it is the
I think it is Wrath.
Oh, I think it's Clash, but I think it's the second one because they fought the Medusa.
Oh, you mean like the remake?
The remake of Clash of the Titans.
Yes.
When you say Clash of the Titans, I only think of the very first movie, which is the real Clash of the Titans.
Yeah.
I don't acknowledge that movie.
Anyway, so
it was really good actually.
So basically these bark-skinned dudes showed up riding a giant millipede, which is another aspect of the game that we haven't mentioned is there are no mounts. So in this game we don't have donkeys and we don't have horses, which are separations of tiers in a BX game where you can get farther and you can actually flee from a lot of the random encounters that might occur as you're, you know, riding around in your environment, whatever it is, in a hex crawl. Do you guys have any thoughts on that?
I know that I want a millipede to ride. As soon as we saw Master Zheng Zhuan on his 15-foot-tall, sleek black millipede, I immediately said, where do I get one of those? That was the most important thing.
Do you need a thrall, the big thralls at the beginning of it? That's the question.
Oh, that's the other interesting thing about this race, is they have thralls that they keep basically attached via vines that grow into the back of their heads. And if that's what it takes to have a millipede, then I guess I'm going to have to get some thralls. Yeah. I'm going to have to get some mind control vines and get myself some thralls so I can get one of them kick-ass millipedes, because It's pretty cool. It can climb down vertical surfaces and interesting things like that. So yeah, definitely it's interesting that we don't have mounts. You don't really notice it too much because I think in a lot of BX games, we don't use mounts early on because we're usually traipsing back and forth to a dungeon that's relatively close by. But in Eric's game, he had mounts.
We're just starting, I think, get to the point where everything's starting to be spread out.
Yeah, in this game, it's what do they call, I like to call them open table games. Some people call them cloud games, or it's based on the West Marches idea where it's kind of a drop in, drop out. You don't have to play every single week, but obviously if you don't play that week, you're not getting any experience. So your character isn't going to advance. It kind of goes with the time every week we play. So it's like a week in between each actual session. Game time is similar to real time in that aspect. It's quite procedural. Like the beginning of every game starts with talking about what henchmen have shown up in Sindonor. Now that'll be different when we're talking about Zatabod, but I haven't even actually decided what all that is because I don't prep that much. But anyway, what's the one thing that's happening? What potions does Habiba Muna have, who is the local witch? And then, they make their rolls to see if they can pick up their hirelings, and then they decide where they're going off to. And even some of those are actually very procedural. I think both of you guys played in the Cassilian Tubes, but you guys don't know what's called that. But the hole that's only available when it's low tide, right?
Right.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, so that is actually a point crawl that's pretty dangerous because the majority of the things that you fight in that are random encounters, which Eric Hoffman would say, run away from random encounters because they don't have any treasure anyway, right?
That's any good dungeon crawl player, OSR style player, runs away from a random encounter because they don't carry anything per the rules most of the time. So that's a little bit of meta.
Yeah, they're just a waste of resources.
Exactly.
I give you guys treasure sometimes in those situations, but it's kind of baked into that point crawl that I have there, which I would say it has probably 50 locations in it, some of them very small and some of them fairly extensive, like the mutated Anolian tribe. You guys ran into that, right? Remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, and another interesting thing about the way you run this West Marches-style campaign is that we always have a focus on almost like a sortie. Every session, we go to a location, we make our hit on it, and then by the end of the session, we're heading back to Sindonor or our home base. Because we know that it's a drop-in, drop-out situation, we know next week new players might be playing, so
exactly.
We always try to get back to our home base, split up the gold, split up the experience, split up the treasure, and everyone's back in their beds by the end of the session.
Another thing I like, too, is how, especially talking about this point crawl, we got some treasure in here we thought was kind of useless. But now that our characters have made it all the way down to Zatabod, all of a sudden we realize, that treasure's not quite so useless. It's definitely got more value somewhere else.
I decided to add that because it just made sense. Some of the items that the Saelvin had for sale were some interesting things. Like some of the characters now have items that they crafted, and the metal that they used is rare on where they come from, which I don't know if we've actually talked about it in play yet, where they come from, but this items or this metal stuff that they found in the Cassilian tubes actually is the same metal just in our location, our land or dimension or whatever. And so they can use it to make this different types of stuff. That's almost like magical items, right?
Yeah. It's interesting. My character got a quote unquote strange metal longsword, and it works like a longsword, magic longsword, plus one to hit and plus one to damage. But it also provides him an ability called Weapon Focus, whereby if I roll a 20, I will do double damage, like a critical hit in a lot of other games. But if I roll a 1, the sword will shatter. And now I'm thinking to myself, boy, I'd really be annoyed if the sword shattered, but I could take those pieces back to them and maybe get it repaired.
Or reforged into something else, yeah.
Yeah, that's possible. I don't know why I haven't gone that far.
Since we can bring shards to them, we found pieces of this metal, and they can use it to craft things, perhaps. If the sword breaks, it won't be perfectly worthless. And then, isn't there armor? Did someone get armor?
Yeah, that's actually a different cloth. It's wizard armor. So basically, it allows them to get the equivalent of leather in BX, but then they have to make a concentration roll to see if their spells are ruined when they cast them.
Concentration roll. That sounds very modern, my friend. Saying you're treading a thin line.
I feel like I do something almost every game that you say that about.
Yeah, that's true. And I do it in jest because I really like the fact, especially in OSR games, that when there is a good idea, no matter where it came from, whether it's another game system or even like 4th edition or another edition, you just bring it in and you use it, you know, because OSR is so open that way. So it is nice that you actually are willing to use those and we're not hamstrung with just the rules as given because there's not a lot there.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that Holmes or Moldvay or any of those guys would say, and they do say, just rules are rulings and then whatever they are, just use them. If those happen to be rules from some other game that work best, then why wouldn't you? That's my opinion, right?
Play what you enjoy.
Yeah, and whatever makes it fun for you, that's true. All right, so you guys want to talk about your characters at all or like a favorite story that it happened or like a favorite location that you explored or anything like that?
Bird, you got anything?
I think for me, one of the things that I found very interesting was our characters, our main characters, were doing all this tramping around the area around Sindonor, and we keep on going, Habibamuna, keep on taking all of her resources, our resources. And then those characters decide, oh, now we gotta go to Zadabad. Come in, second day of the week, our second characters come in, and Habibamuna's like, I'm out of resources, so she puts us on a quest to actually resupply her so we can actually continue to get more healing salves and what have you.
For greedy-ass first-week characters.
I thought that was a really great incorporation of like the West Marches of where one set of characters has an impact on another group and to it now makes a direct effect to them, so now our second group of characters are having to compensate for what the first characters did.
To me, it's interesting that that's your interpretation of what happened, when in reality, I have a random table for what she has on her, and part of that random table sometimes is sending the characters on a quest. That's the emergent storytelling.
Yeah, but that's my perception.
That's the emergent storytelling in the game, is people will take their interpretations of random roles, and just as the thing go, a story will be created out of that, and that is awesome. And that makes a lot of sense what you said though as well, John. Then I like that you like that about it. That's cool. It's kind of like I'm slapping your face saying, no, that's not the way it went. But in reality to you, that is your perception. And so that is the way it went. So that's cool. What about you, Jose?
Well, I'll mention my main character, my Monday character. It started as an NPC. One of my many female wizards died again. As we talked about in the previous podcast I did, you have a problem with female wizards. So again, she died, and her henchman, so that I could continue playing, it might be something you have against me, I decided to play the henchman. And his name was Carlton. You kept spelling it wrong. You spelled it C-A-L-T-O-N, but it's Carlton with an R.
I think it's K-A-L-T-O-N.
And I went and I had to go make a Carlton image. Which you can share. You're welcome to share. So that you knew it was the Carlton. He's an interesting character because every week you still get his name wrong. You insist that his name is Calton and it's Carlton. It's Carlton. And I think everyone knows, based on my age, the Carlton I'm thinking of. That's the interesting thing about that, is your inability to call my character by his proper name.
It's funny that that's your story, is me trying to say the character's name that I originally gave him as an NPC and you changing it into the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air's little brother. So I don't know, man. This is just the crazy stuff that happens during our games.
Yeah, and he's now in a nice set of leather armor. I photoshopped it in so that there would be proof. And so long live Carlton, the fighter.
So in that game, one of the most important aspects to me of a hex crawl, especially one worth a drop in, drop out, where you're constantly going to be adding new first level characters. And even more so when you take a lot of the higher level characters and take them to a new area, which is going to be their new headquarters, you got to have tons and tons of low level places to go and explore and try to get treasure so you can go up in levels. Right.
Yeah. That's a tough part of hex crawls.
Yeah. That's one of the parts that you have to deal with when you're dealing with a level based system.
And so I have tons of them, and I started with just pictures that I found or made and showed you guys and gave you a quick rumor, and then it was up to you if you wanted to go there or not. One of the ones you had a lot of fun with was the God's Hollow. when Jose's first time there, he had to play with the logs from the jungle, but basically it's a cenote in the middle of the jungle with some kind of kraken down in the water, right?
And what is a cenote for those of us who are dense?
A cenote is like, it used to maybe be a volcano, so there's a large area below, and there's just like a hole in the ground, right? I mean, I guess I don't know what the official definition is.
Yeah, it's like a hole, like it was like a hole in the ground, and at the bottom there was like a...
There's a big pool of water.
Yeah, yeah, and it was interesting. Now, you mentioned the logs. I just had a lot of ideas about using, like, sliding logs in, because... Okay, first of all, we went into the cenote, and he didn't mention that the previous people, there was a giant tentacle monster in the water. So I was thinking of using the logs, A, to drop on the tentacle monster or to make a walkway. I mean, we ended up collapsing some stuff and smashing the side of the wall, and we ended up not killing the tentacle monster, but...
It was a pretty cool scene regardless. I thought that was cool the way that the environment changed just by what you guys decided to do. And it added more tension and capabilities for you guys to get around. So that was one of my favorite parts probably. I'm going to actually probably release that adventure eventually on the zine for Hobbs and Friends of the OSR so listeners can check it out.
But a couple of times we've caught you, like you'll mention like a rumor, like something offhand, and I don't think you expect us to glom onto it real hard. You know, you've already dropped other seeds, or we've said we're going to do something else, and we'll hear it, and we'll be like, that's where we're going.
That's every time, Jose.
And you'll be like, no, that's where we're going. And you'll be like, well, I didn't really prep that yet, and so you curse a bit, and then we hear you prepping maps and doing a bunch of stuff, and the game gets a little bit lax. Because if you mention anything that you haven't prepped yet, the players will invariably want to go there.
Yeah, no shit.
And we've done it at least once or twice.
Yeah.
Twice. Maybe three times, so.
Yeah, so I thought that was funny.
And I think that's where all his female wizards died. I don't know.
Maybe it was. I was insistent on some of those.
No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, no, you aren't.
I'm just kidding. All right, so I think that covers the Kalmata game. So I want to do a product spotlight, and it's kind of a little... I don't know. It's a little question here that I had. We don't have a lot of time to talk about it, Jose, but...
What does that mean?
Fifth edition Dungeons & Dragons. It came out last year already? Has it been a year?
A long time.
Been at least a year, yeah.
Maybe two.
Yeah, it's been a while, and all of us have some experience with it. And I had... Each of you guys can have a minute to talk. Is Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition an OSR game? Jose?
I do not think it is an OSR game. I think it has some aspects of an OSR game, but really that is based on the definition of OSR, which is subjective to the person. So you may find pieces of it that are OSR for you, or you may see things like that. I don't personally see it, although I enjoy the game very much. I play it, and as a matter of fact, the game I'm playing in now is a 5th edition Isle of Dread campaign. So, and it runs really well, and we're having a lot of fun with it, and it doesn't get more OSR than Isle of Dread. So, I'm changing my opinion. Yeah, it's an OSR game 100%. I'm done.
Bird?
I'm not going to say it's per se an OSR game, because I think it brings a lot of modern sensibilities to the game design, whereas I feel more OSR games are more to open interpretation, whereas this has a little bit more rulings set to it. Now, me being a person who I really do like rules, I really dig it, and I really like it, and I really like how they streamlined everything, and I especially think it's a lot better improvement from 4th edition, which, while yes, I've been given the nickname the Chess Master, that's even a little bit too much for me.
Okay. I say it's as OSR as the GM is going to make it. If the GM is just kind of flying by the seat of his pants and he's just not looking into all the rules that they baked in, which I think they baked in for organized play more than anything, when they were trying to have, you know, different GMs and different players run the exact same modules, and then you could use characters for different games for their actual, they call it AP or whatever. I've never done it, but I think that's why they did it. But I think if some guy is just running it for a couple of his buddies, it can be as OSR as anything. Cause like, I feel like when I run it, it's pretty OSR. What do you think, Bird?
I think when you run it, it does seem closer to the OSR. I mean, there's a couple of new things that we have to deal with that the new rules provide. But yeah, I do agree with you when you're saying that they baked in a bunch of rules for Adventure League.
Yeah, Adventure League. Yeah. Does that change your thoughts anymore, Jose, or no? Are you still right where you were before?
No, I'm back to it not being OSR at all. I've had some time to think about it.
All right, you're done. Do I have a mute for you anywhere? I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. All right, so the last thing I want to do is make a shout out to the Three Castles RPG Design Awards, which are chosen at North Texas RPG Con, and Treasure Vaults of Zadabad is one of the four finalists. The other three are Victorious by Stephen Chenault, Hero's Journey by James Spahn, and Maze of the Blue Medusa by Zach Smith. All of those are really great products. Obviously, I get Treasure Vaults of Zadabad a ton of love, because Eric's awesome, but also I give him a lot of crap about his products when I'm running it. But in general, I think that's a pretty great achievement. Well, what do you guys think? You got anything to say about that?
I think the other three products are toilet paper, and the only one worth buying is Zadabot. Bird, what do you think?
I have to say, I love my experience with what we've been doing with Zadabot, so I can't say anything bad about it.
Oh, all right. Awesome. All right, so I want to do some other quick shout-outs, which would be my Patreon. We have a Patreon for Hobbs and Friends of the OSR. It's at patreon.com/OSR, the letter N, Hobbs, if you want to check that out. We're doing some nice things for Patreons. I hope they'll like it. We expect to release the quarterly zine in the next few weeks, maybe sooner than that. I have tons and tons of art for it, and it looks pretty flipping awesome, actually. You can reach me at Hobbs Indeed on the Twitters, or you can reach at OSRN Hobbs on the Twitters for the actual podcast. I'm Jason Hobbs on G+, or you can reach me at HobbsandFriends@misdirectedmark.com. How about you guys? Where could they reach you if they wanted to?
I'm unreachable. I'm off the grid.
Jose is at yank.com. Bird, anywhere?
I'm on G+.
John Bird is his G+ name.
Yep.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, you guys. I really appreciate you talking about my game, and I appreciate you having you guys on. All right, guys, I'll talk to you later.
Hobbs and Friends of the OSR is a Misdirected Mark production, the media arm of Encoded Designs, and it is brought to you by these fine patrons: Julian Burnick, Eric Hoffman, and Rick Hull. Thank you very much for patroning Hobbs and Friends of the OSR, and we'll talk to you next time.